Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes, like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. In our first book, Amy wrote about stumbling onto the term God, etc., as coined by artist and witch Maria Molteni. This terminology has since become core for how we think about witchcraft. We see our practice as politics, art, and spirituality, reaching beyond gender binaries to a power in the earth and each other that is multiple, fertile, delightful, divergent, and fucking delicious. People find different entry points to the God, etc., and those are unique to them and their true nature and nurture and heritage. They might be moved by archetypes like Freya or Hecate, or experience a homecoming by honoring queer ancestors, or develop a satisfying, mind-bending relationship with a cedar grove. This kind of magic craft, spirit craft, witchcraft is all related and glorious in the infinite eyes of the God, etc., because it strengthens our kinship and helps heal what centuries of capitalism and colonialism have broken in us. Over and over again in our coven, we see folks connect with the great big openness of this idea of divinity, and it is electric. So here's the excerpt from Missing Witches, Reclaiming True Histories of Feminist Magic, with all our love and adoration to that bee-witch, bad bitch, and baller, Maria Molteni. Witches know that words are spells, capable of creating or changing reality. In discussions around contemporary spirituality, I have seen the words God and goddess replaced with God, etc., coined, I believe, by artist and self-described queerdo Maria Molteni. And I think that's a perfect description, what we as humans can imagine of that which is beyond, etc., and so on, plus more. And this week's reading was from Risa Dickens and Amy Turek. And the book, again, is Missing Witches, Reclaiming True Histories of Feminist Magic. Welcome back to Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers. And today I am sitting down with Amy Turek and Risa Dickens, the magical creators behind the Missing Witches podcast, books, and coven. And so, yeah, we're going to be talking about friendship today. We're going to be talking about grief, caretaking, illness, and how witchcraft is really helping us all and supporting us on our collective journeys. So, I want to just open up with you all just saying anything you want. This is a very impromptu three-piece this morning. So, yeah, let's just start with Amy or Risa. Anything you want to just start with to start the conversation, how you're arriving to the conversation today?
I'll start by saying I'm so happy you're in my, it's actually not my home, but you're in my space, yeah. Which is really such a really nice gift. We are like internet friends who became IRL friends, and that always feels like magic, like someone jumped through a portal.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I'm really excited about that. And I love getting to talk with Amy in like different contexts because she's like my best friend and business life partner. As she introduced herself to everybody at my wedding. Hello, I'm Risa's business life partner. Is that what you said? Something like that.
I said business partner and then I added life partner because business partner just didn't feel like adequate, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel a lot of joy in this moment. It's fun to get to talk about our work and our collaboration with like a dear friend from a new perspective. That is a certain kind of magic in repositioning yourself like that.
Yeah.
And as someone who's like in active cancer treatment, it's interesting to think about care and grief.
Yeah.
So I'm It's not a fun topic. It's nice to walk into that container together. So
yeah. And so just for you all who are not in the rooms with us, so Risa and I are in one place and Amy is joining from her home. So the two of us are in one room and Amy's on the Zoom. So we are looking at each other, looking at each other. So this is just a very interesting convergence this morning. So yeah, Amy, what about you? How are you arriving?
Look at me. I'm Amy. I'm arriving, as I always do, with a humble gratitude for the sun and the air and the earth beneath my feet. I guess what I want people to know about me is that, like, I'm a punk from way back, and there's so much overlap between that kind of punk ethos and that witch ethos. Yeah. So for me, it was like a very natural way. I mean, Risa, you and I have talked about this before. Like, I don't remember a time in my life where I didn't think of myself as a witch. Wow. You know? And there are many reasons for that, but a lot of it comes down to just seeing the world differently and recognizing that what I had been told by society, by patriarchy, and that kind of hegemony, just isn't true. That you can live your life any way that you want to. You have to deal with the consequences of your choices, always, obviously. But that the laws of man are not the laws of physics, I guess. Which is to say, like, people say, "Oh, I can't do that," or "You can't do that," but you can. You can, you know. Can I, like, cut my hair and dye it a funny color? Oh, I can't do that. Well, of course you can, you know. Can I jump up and flap my arms and fly? Like, no, you know, there are laws, and then there are laws, and recognizing the difference between those laws is like a major foundation builder for me in my entire life.
Yeah. So I'm curious about you saying you always identified as a witch. So what was sort of young Amy like in that way, that knew that you were sort of plugged into something different?
I mean, I've said this so many times, but, you know, I grew up in the 80s and we got fairy tales a lot, and it seemed like, you know, girls had two choices. You could either be the princess or the witch in those stories. And I just never related to the princess. I never had someone galloping in on a steed to save me. I knew that if I was going to get saved, I was going to have to save myself. And there is that, like, fierce, scary, almost, archetype of the witch who is in charge of her own life, who can, I'm sorry, what's your policy on cursing?
Oh, we curse on the podcast.
So, a person who does their own thing, and if you fuck with her, then she's gonna do something about it, and she knows that she's not only in charge of her life, but she understands how to work with nature. She understands her own boundaries. She lives alone in the woods, you know, all of these things that I don't live alone. I have a dog and a spouse, but just that kind of, like, fierce, independent, nature loving DIY punk rock ethos of not be waiting around to be saved by a handsome prince, but to take your life into your own hands, you know?
Yeah. That makes me think of a recent post that you all did on the podcast about being the most dangerous person on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And so now when I'm walking down the street and I'm feeling a little nervous coming home late at night, I'm like, I'm the most dangerous person on the street. I mean,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I was fucking scary when I was a teenager, like, deliberately. The look was repulsive as opposed to attractive, you know. I wasn't looking to be attractive. I was looking to be a force of nature. And so that's how I adorned myself. That was the armor that I put on, was like a crazy outfit and crazy makeup and crazy hair. Like, don't mess with me, I'm crazy.
Yeah. Risa, what about you? What was your sort of entry into this? Were you always a witch, or?
Yeah, I was always a witch, you know. It was never, like, a word that I felt like it was a big revelation to step into, mm-hmm. you know? It was so, for me, it was like very much play and art practice and sort of speaking to my politics, like that I always sort of felt like the world, I could have faith that the world could be like radically beautiful and that we weren't trapped in the glamour delusion of inequality. Like I've always had this faith that like our will can be exerted towards yeah. like glorious futures. Even when I was like a little kid and I was like scared or heartbroken by the world, I always felt like I could talk to the wind and that she would come, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I still feel like that. And I mm-hmm. tell my kid that, you know?
Yeah.
And I really, you know, my parents are psychologists, my mom and stepdad, and my dad's a playwright. So there was always this idea that you could like, that art could make a reality and you yeah. could step into the portal of that reality.
Yeah.
And also that our minds are incredibly powerful
yeah.
and incredibly flexible and that we do literally create our realities mm-hmm. through our minds.
Mm-hmm.
My stepdad was telling me the other day, his coworkers were asking him like, what do? You never get sick. And he said, oh, I take my placebo every morning. I was like, I really relate to this kind of magical thinking, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You and I are the same, even though we're very different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a circuitous way of answering, I guess. I remember playing with fashion my whole life as a way of trying to signal to other weirdos. Yeah, so I relate to what Amy said there about not trying to be attractive, although I did that too. Like I liked to be like sexy powerful too mm-hmm. when I was a bit older.
Yeah.
But I wore a lot of like weird hats, like a lot of elaborate top hats and bow ties and tail coats and steel-toed boots, you know, like I was like a 13, like gender bending in really wow. weird traumatic ways.
Yeah.
And I think I always liked the idea. And that's part of what we started playing with when we started to create Missing Witches was this idea that I could create a context, whether it was through producing an event or just like a gathering of friends or whatever, where I could like gently nudge into being that feeling that could emerge where like things were sort of suddenly glimmery and possible and that like, yeah, you could get certain things right, the music and the lighting and the right combination of people mm-hmm. and the right sort of suggestions that mm-hmm. like you could feel new possibilities emerge.
Yeah.
I think I've always been that kind of witch.
Yeah. I love that because I definitely am the same. I definitely have that same sort of orientation to life that I could do whatever. It was always possible for me. And it's interesting as you both are saying this, because we don't always look at the witch that way. When we look at the way that witches are portrayed in the media, they're not really portrayed the way we're talking. So do you all feel like you're on a reclamation journey of the idea of witches through the podcast, through the books, through the coven? What do you think about that sort of?
I don't know if we need to reclaim because we have always had it.
Yeah.
But I think that there's definitely an aspect of translation. Mm. That what does this mean to you? Mm. You know, having a lit degree is all about that kind of like, you know, here's a 3-line poem and write me 6 pages about it, what it means. And that's kind of what we do with the witch too. I mean, we are not only capable of the kind of world building that Riso is talking about, but we're like responsible for it too. We're yeah. responsible for our own lives. And I think a lot of people just hand over the responsibility of their lives to like society and the rules of society, what their parents told them to do, what capitalism tells them is important, and don't make any of those choices for themselves. So again, for me, the word witch isn't like so much as a noun as it is like an adjective, maybe an adverb or a verb too. It's not about what we are so much as what we do. And again, the lens through which we see the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a witch will look at something differently than someone who doesn't relate to that word will look at the same thing.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this relationship between witchiness and queerness, because they both sort of exist outside of what people would have us think is the norm. I'd love to get both of your, Reese, I'll start with you, your sort of idea around that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you think about using queer as a verb, the idea of queering spaces, queering relationships, queering dynamics to make them more open to possibilities and to sort of allow that habitual constraint that Amy was talking about to be sort of shaken up.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a strong relationship there mm-hmm. with the way that we think about witching.
Mm-hmm.
Especially thinking about like witchcraft as a craft, as a practice, as like a way of being, a way of interacting. There's like a real strong relationship to that. And I think for me, like in terms of gender and like love possibilities, there's something there that's related to, you know,
yeah.
like witchcraft. I mean, people will claim it in whatever way they want, I guess, but for me it's really like it has an idea of the multiplicity of our love and the multiplicity of our relationships in it, the kind of undoes the pressure to find everything in one partner who's at the opposite of a gender binary and to sort of have that be your whole world and to get everything from that person, where witchcraft and a queering of relationships sort of opens up for me a space to say, like, well, I have a creative life partner in Amy, and like I can turn to like a really rich web of women mostly and queer people, and then also like invite men into these women's spaces and ask of them to be like with us in those spaces and to be partners with us in those ways. And like to have all that sort of juicy richness of relationship,
mm-hmm.
even relationship with the more than human world and our animal kinships and our plant relationships, mm-hmm. like to kind of open up where I get my love and support and validation from.
Yeah.
Is another thing I think that witching and queer ecologies have in common.
Yeah, it's sort of this expansiveness, and Amy, what you were saying, like we can have the life that we want.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, because when I think about it, it's like sort of quote unquote normal society. Maybe we need to find a better word for it. But the society that sort of we exist outside of by choice has a tendency to make us small.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what we're talking about is expansive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Amy, I would just love to hear, you know, you riff on that idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much overlap between the out queer community and the witch community, because I mean, it's exactly what we were talking about before. You know, I was always drawn to out queer people because they had sadly heteroromantic over here, but people who are out, who are queer, have this idea that you're not going to tell me who I am. And you have a choice to come out and say, this is who I am, this is who I love, this is how I operate in the world, and to take the heat that comes with that. You know, there are very real consequences. Mm-hmm. Or you can just pretend to be something you're not and live this sort of, you know, protected but not protected sort of lie about your life. And so when I saw out queer people, you know, when I was a kid, I was like, that's it. These people have made a decision to reject the rules of society. I'm using scare quotes here for those who can't see me. Those rules of society that tell me that I can't exist authentically. And I think the witch has that too. You look at the world and say, okay, these are the rules, but I don't fit into that. You know, we bring up Audre Lorde's the mythical norm all the time. She talks about like what is normal and how few humans actually fit into that box of what is normal, you know, straight, healthy, able-bodied, you know, thin, white, wealthy, all of these things that so many of us just don't fit into, but that's what's considered the norm. And again, that's why growing up, I was very drawn to queer culture, queer art, the out queer community, because they were these people who had, as I said, like made a choice to value their own authenticity, like what they felt or knew in their hearts above what hegemonic society was trying to tell them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I want to sort of go back in time, just building on this idea of what we're talking about, and go back to sort of Missing Witches, the early days, I guess we could say, of Missing Witches at this point. What were some of your, as you were building that container, were these some of the components? Like, I know you both said, like, this started sort of, you went into it as an art project. But what was it that you all were sort of intentionally wanting to create? Because it is a very welcoming, open space for all of us who, you know, are a part of it.
It's funny because we didn't start out intending to create a community.
Wow.
At all. The initial project was like the 6-episode season, you know.
And that was it.
And like it turned into 12 because Amy was going to add interviews, which right away started to build community.
Okay.
Right. Going from scripted research based pieces to having the complimentary episodes that are like our Witches Found series, that are interviews, not just with witches, but contemporary practitioners of all kinds of esoteric or traditional religions or folk practices, or also academics, artists. And that was really like having those interviews really expanded for us and showed us what we were trying to do, right?
So mm.
It's not just this, it's also that, like, I also want artists. We also need activists. We also need like queer performers who identify as creating their realities, their worlds. Like, it's also this, it's also this. And so that helped us to see what we were doing. It was partially like showing us what we were doing with who we were choosing to write histories of too. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like beginning to intentionally create community, there's definitely always been, in the way that we are friends and the way that we like try to include or invite other people into our witch practice, there's like some aspects to us that are really core, that are like, well, one we used to always say, this was just when we were practicing witches, we didn't have the podcast, but we would always say, the goddess forgives. This is like classic Amy. The goddess forgives, guys. Like, you don't have to get everything fucking right. You don't need to like buy a list of ingredients off of some spell on the internet. Like, that's not how this works. That's not what this practice is. That's not what we're doing. That's not what we're interested in. So if for us, it was like, really, it was an extension of how we already played together, playing mm-hmm. music, talking, like riffing, being excited about things, watching each other collaborate with other people and being like, you deserve a really great collaborator. Like, you deserve mm-hmm. to have people around you who show up all the way you show up. I remember watching Amy collaborate and being like, I want to collaborate with you and I want to show up all the way you show up. Like, because I could see sometimes she'd collaborate with people and be a bit like, oh, like, come on, like, can't we be on time? Can't we, like, if Amy's going to do something, she's going to do it.
Yeah.
She's going to be all the way there.
Yeah.
So that was an element, too, I think, of the kind of community we wanted to create. One that was, like, really, like, defying this expectation that you had to do XYZ in a certain way. and one that was really welcoming to our bodies and our failings and our failures, but one that was also like, but a little bit DIY and a little bit like, well, fucking build it. Like, let's fucking do it. Let's, yeah. What are you capable of? You're capable of everything. So let's not play halfway. Let's play. Let's play all the way, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's sort of a mishmash answer.
So, you know, some of the things we've talked about is sort of existing on the outside, I guess, but maybe we're really on the inside and they're on the outside because there's more of us than like them. But this thing about witchery and dealing in the unseen and thinking about this sort of grief conversation, I'm wondering if your practices have helped you deal with grief. Like specifically you, Amy, with your caretaking of your dad, one of the things you said was that you don't talk about it because people feel uncomfortable. And so I'd love for you to talk about that, but also talk about like how your magical practice helped you move through that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the difference between like being a caregiver for a parent or an elder caregiver and like having a child is that like nobody thought my dad was cute. Nobody wanted to be around him because he was very difficult. And so again, it just came down to this idea of no one's coming to save you. You know, I might have saved him, but no one was coming to save me. And I knew that. And I didn't talk about it. And I don't talk about it again, because I think because he was so difficult when he died, people sort of treated it like I should be celebrating. Like it was such a relief that he was gone. And that's true. You know, our family doctor said to me, you know, it's okay to feel relieved. And that was so beautiful of her to say that. But I felt like everybody felt like that. I didn't get the kind of outpouring that a lot of people get when they lose their parents because he was so difficult. So I did get a lot of, after he died, not in the 9 years that I was looking after him, but after he died, a lot of people were like, you're so amazing, you're so strong, you're so beautiful, you're so brave, you know, a lot of platitudes.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done that. Am I capable of that myself, making about themselves, like as if I'm judging people for making decisions that are different than mine, and I'm not. But yeah, I mean, how did witchcraft help me with that? Again, I think it's just like, I have never blamed anyone for my choices. And I think that a lot of people are looking for someone to blame for the choices that they made. And I will say, you know, my sister still carries a lot of resentment, you know, like he wasn't a good dad. Like I can say that off the jump. And so my sister carries a lot of the weight of that. But for me, when you see someone like as a child, when you see their vulnerability, it makes forgiveness so much more possible than when you see them as this authority figure, I guess.
Yeah.
And so again, for me, the overlap of like being a witch, doing witchcraft, is that I knew that I had made choices and I was responsible for my choices. And in terms of the grief, I mean, there were a lot of times where I would just go and talk to the moon about it. You know, when he was like screaming curse words in the middle of the night and my husband and I couldn't sleep. I would just have to go to another place, you know, like not a true disassociation, but like the witchy disassociation where you're like, the world is so full of energies. You know, there are so many things that are happening in the mycelial network that are going to help me. I'm going to watch, you know, my lilies pop up again next spring. Thing will continue. And also just the, how do I put this? The sort of expansive power of love. I think caring for my father helped me to love better because I didn't take care of him because I owed him something, because I didn't owe him anything, you know? Again, not a great dad. I did it because I had this love in me for not even humanity, you know, for the world itself. And I feel like, you know, so much of what Risa and I do is that kind of the care aspect of community. You know, like, I'm always making sure to tell people I'm so proud of them. I'm so happy for you. You know, we are collaborators. We are not in competition, because so much of the world feels like that. It feels like you're in competition with 8 billion other people for these resources or for this attention or whatever is happening. Yeah. And when you can see someone suffering and alleviate some of that suffering or alleviate some of that fear, that to me is kind of the highest witchcraft, you know. Yeah. We talk about changing our lives, but we can really change other people's lives too, and that's just something that like fills me in like almost a religious way. I feel like I went off on a lot of spiraling tangents there, but hopefully there was something in there that answered your question.
Yeah, no, I love it. And, you know, I love a tangent. And it's like, that feels like the coven itself. You know, I could say for me, there have been times where I want to post something about a project and I'm like, oh, I'm taking up too much space. I posted too much this. And then it's like, no, girl, wait a minute. It says share your magic. Like, they literally are asking you to share your magic, right? And so even though it was unintentional that you created this space, you definitely created a space for us to not go through our grief by ourselves.
Yeah, I'll say it wasn't a goal at the outset, mm-hmm. but the way that it is shaped is intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that. Like, mm-hmm. once we started to realize, like, oh, we're going to not just have a Patreon of people supporting our project, but we're going to make the investment to build a space for community to support each other. There's a lot of things that we have thought about and that I've written and thought about for a long time. Like, I used to write about the history of open source, you know. Mm. I'm really interested in gift economy. I'm really interested in like making a space where we teach each other for free and where we don't have to position ourselves as gurus. Like, I didn't want to slip down that road of like, you write a book and then you start a coaching practice or something, and then you coach other people to become coaches in the great pyramid scheme of coaching, you know. I was like, what is a different dynamic than that? And so much, especially of American capitalist culture, is a pyramid scheme now, that it's really hard to like push out of that and like craft a different way of being together.
Yeah.
But it is something that we really are trying to make in that space where you could say that you want to learn something and learn it together without having to be an expert in it. Or mm-hmm. that we could create spaces where we come into a Missing Witches community space and we're not the gurus or the experts there. Like, we're like circle casters or something, but we can come with our own vulnerability or our own questions and our awe of everyone who's in there and the brilliance of the people who are in there.
I want to add something to that, that like, I think we've all experienced this thing. And I know so many people in my life, they want us to be small. And so if you said something positive about yourself, or let me put it for me, if I said something positive about myself, I would have to follow it with like a little self-deprecating joke in order to make that person feel more comfortable with me being, you know, less than them or not greater than them. And so it's very specific when we come into our space. Like, we open the door, we tell people brag. we want to know how amazing you are. And if you don't know, then we're going to tell you. You know, Risa, I don't know if you remember this. I won't say her last name, but Sarah said that one of her favorite quotes from me to her was, cut it with your bullshit. Like, stop pretending that you're not an amazing, powerful, sexy, brilliant, because you are. And she was a little bit shy, and we just watched her over the course of years just open up into this, like, I don't want to say loudmouth because that has a bad connotation, but like someone who was willing to speak their mind, who wasn't going to put themselves, who wasn't going to hide away, because we're encouraging that. We're witches. That's the whole point. Like, yeah. we want you to understand how fucking powerful you are. We don't want you to shrink so we feel smarter. I never want to be the smartest person in the room. Never, 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 never. Some people, they have to be the smartest person in the room, or they'll, I don't know what the word is, but like, you know, they feel uncomfortable if they're not like having some kind of superiority.
Yeah.
Over everyone around them. And that's the opposite of what we want. We want a circle, you know, but we don't want a stage and audience, you know. We want a circle where everyone can look at each other, everyone can hear each other, where you can brag, because like we say all the time, like, we're a team. If you succeed, I'm succeeding. We're collaborators. So if you do something great, then I feel like that also reflects on me and I feel a little bit greater. I don't feel less than, I feel more, because my team is doing great.
Yeah, that's such a different, it's just a completely different way to look at the way that so much of the world functions. And I wonder about this thing, I've been talking about this a lot on the podcast and in my private life too, about sort of what we give up to get there. Like, what parts of myself did I have to shed to get through my caregiving, right? And so I'm wondering, do you even feel like you had to give up any parts of yourself to like step into this missing witches role that you didn't know you were gonna like step into? I'd love to start there and then go a little bit deeper than that.
That question is really concrete for me these days, right?
Okay.
I was laid off from a job I had had for 10 years after I started Missing Witches because of COVID. So I like had to shed this sort of corporate success that I had put on, you know, like I had a certain salary and like I worked in tech, travel for work.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I had all of that kind of social success.
Yes.
And that had to go. And it had to go in a certain way that like was really empowering and uplifting for myself as a witch, partially because it involved ego death. You know, like we have to go the whole wheel for our power. Like, and we have to do it over and over again. And we have to accept that we're gonna do it over and over again. And we have to fully die over and over again to know that we will die. And every one of those gives us like a huge dose of power.
Yeah.
It really does, because you made it through. So that alone,
yes,
is like a huge uplift of a wave. But you make it through lighter, like you shed shit that you realized you were holding on to. And then like cancer. Like I didn't know I was going to do this part, but I have literally like put on the altar of my life, my breasts, my hair, my lymph nodes, I'll put my uterus, I'm going to put anything that I can, onto the altar of my life so that I can live. And I'm in a point where I'm kind of thrilled about it, to be honest. I'm a witch who loves the sciences. I'm really protective, even more so now under the current regime. More protective of the sciences and the scientific method, and the like structures of care that people have fought for for decades, you know, and to see going through cancer treatment, to see how that is 90% being upheld and pushed forward by women of color. And so to see that work and to see how long many of us in like countercultural movements talked about, you know, the medical industry, the medical complex as though it were somehow evil, because it is allied with profit. You know, it has been distorted by capital. But yeah, being brought through that space has made me sort of have to shed some of the simple binaries again.
Yeah.
That we do, where we're like, that's corporate, that's, and only natural is good, you know? And then we're like, actually, like, all of this science, all of this research, all of these people who died in clinical trials trying to take the science step one step forward, further, I'm incredibly like allied and loyal to them and to all the patients in all the chemo rooms and all the caregivers who like have shit talked to them all day long by people who are terrified. Like I feel furiously loyal to those people. And that is part of the joy of my survival right now. It's like, I want it to be known more than ever that witchcraft is like a science loving practice, that that witches have always been scientists, that like we meet in our curiosity about the edge of what is known. And so we love, so the sciences and, you know, the spiritualists and the witches, like we have this in common, this question about what is known.
Absolutely.
But to disparage each other means we're missing out on all the richness that our ancestors fought for and carried forward. So that's part of how I'm thinking about the things I had to shed to be in this moment where I'm like thrilled to be like shorn and alive, you know?
I was in I was getting an MRI a couple years ago, and I remember when I was in that thing, I was like, damn, thank you, aliens. Like, that's where I went immediately. I immediately went to, oh, thank you, aliens, and thank you for the downloads that you gave the humans to create these computers that now I'm like getting my shit checked out. Like, that's, but I used to be very much like, I'm not going to doctors and like, yeah, that was, I was one of those.
I get it.
Until I had to, you know, go to the doctor. And,
Right.
And one of my good friends who's a chiropractor was like, listen, everybody's working with their toolbox.
Yeah.
And some people just have a smaller toolbox than others. Mm-hmm. And that helped me to sort of, you know, shift my thinking. But I want to pick up on this ego death conversation and this shedding, Amy, as you know, my caretaking, also sister of a difficult parent. Boy, ego death after ego death at my house. I'd love to hear about sort of that for you, what you had to shed in that process, if you felt like you had to shed anything.
First, I want to say that, you know, what Reese is talking about with witchcraft and science, we don't see them as separate entities. Yes. And because we refuse to reject the tens of thousands of years of science that people were doing before, you know, there's this idea that humans hit this moment and everything before that is just baloney. No, people were experimenting with plants, as you know, as one example, for thousands and thousands of years to discover that mint was good for your stomach, to discover that chamomile, as another example, was soothing. So part of that for us is wholeheartedly rejoicing in science, but not just contemporary science, also recognizing the science that our ancestors upon ancestors upon ancestors have been doing for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. I'll get to caregiving, but in terms of like, in terms of sacrifice, something that comes up in our coven a lot is sacrificing likability in order to advocate for yourself. And I think that that is why a lot of people don't advocate for themselves, because they don't want to cause a problem. They want, I want you to like me, so I'm not going to make a fuss. And I know, Risa, like, in your cancer journey, there have been times where you had to say, no, wait a second. Can you check that again? What you're saying is, you know, and these are people in authority positions, you know, like medical professionals, and maybe you're meant to just be like, okay, well, whatever bit of care you can give me, I'm super grateful, da, 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 da. And instead, you have to be that bitch sometimes. Yeah. And a lot of people are, you know, unwilling to do that out of fear, which I get. It's not that I don't get it. It's that I went through a very hard road to chip away at that idea that being liked was more important than being valued, than being healthy, than having fucking bodily autonomy. Like, don't touch me. You know, like, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm going to be like, don't touch me. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if somebody's in my way, I'm not going to shove them, but I'm not going to wait for them to move. I'm just going to go around. You know, of course I care if people like me or not. I want everyone to like me. But the fact is, like, not everyone's going to like me. And if I have to choose between, like, being liked by you or loving myself and taking care of myself. And it's so amazing how many people will choose being liked by strangers than actually giving themselves proper care. Sacrificing to be a caregiver? I mean, how much time do we have? You have to sacrifice everything to be a caregiver. Everything. Your freedom, you know, your social life, the ability to travel, sleep. there are so many things that you have to let go of in order to take this on. And I can't tell you whether it was worth it or not, but I can tell you that I don't regret it.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense.
But in the same breath, like, I'm telling people, like, don't do this. Like, you, it's going to be so much harder than you think. That's my advice for people who are thinking about taking on the caregiving of their parents or other elders in their family or their community. It's just like, it's going to be so much harder than you think. And so you have to mentally prepare for that. I was fully unprepared. Everything was a surprise, you know? Absolutely. Every hurdle was a surprise.
Yeah.
One of my girlfriends, her mother died of ALS. And she said to me once, you know, there are only a certain number of people in the world who know what their parents' asshole feels like.
Period.
And it changes, you know, who yes. touched their parents' assholes, to be blunt. And more. And it changes you, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
To flip that of, like, these are the people that are supposed to be looking after you, and now you're looking after them. It's a real mind fuck.
Yes.
And something that I think maybe in other parts of the world, in other societies, like, I'm saying not North American, it's different. It's just a given, you know. That's grandma's right. going to live with you
That's right.
after grandpa dies. And, yeah. you know, my mother put my grandmother in a home. I don't blame her. You know, it was impossible for her, or the way she saw it, it would be impossible. But most of the world doesn't operate like that.
No.
And so it's really interesting to me how people reacted to that choice that my husband and I made. Like, shock, horror that we would do this. And we're kind of looking around like, most of the world is just a given that this is what you're going to do.
Yeah.
So you have to sacrifice your expectations. I mean, I could go on and on and on. The list of sacrifices is much too long for the amount of time that we have today.
Yeah. Is there, and it's going to be different for every person, but yes, absolutely. Like, all of the things you said, plus 100. I wonder if there's anything besides don't do it, which people are going to do it. So Is there anything that people should understand? Because I, like you, was completely like surprised. I had no idea I would like wind up in this situation the way it rolled out. So is there anything that people might want to understand if they're going to be in it for the long haul?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of like, it feels like a waking dream now. You know, my father's been dead for like 6 years. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my spouse and I are just like, how did we do that?
Yeah.
How did we even do that? Things get normalized. And again, this is something that happens in your house, in your society, in your country. And you're just like, well, and then, you know, someone looking from the outside would be absolutely horrified by what's going on in your house. But for you, it's normal.
Yeah.
Advice, ideas, I have none, because your journey is going to be completely different than mine.
Yeah.
I would say, sit down with like literally everyone you know, I guess, and tell them like, I've made this decision and I'm going to need help. I'm going to need support. Because again, people kind of fall all over themselves to babysit your beautiful little child, right? They're so cute. I can't wait to play. But when you have like a literally shitty old man, I mean, I had one girlfriend. She had very, very generously offered to look after my father for the night. We were going away. And, you know, he was fine on his own for a few hours. So I was like, we're going to leave it at 3 o'clock. You know, you're off at work at 5. You're going to go straight there. And my father starts calling me on my cell phone. He's hungry. He's alone. He's scared. And I'm calling my friend, like, where is she? Where is she? She's not picking up the phone. She's not picking up the phone. And I'm talking to my spouse. I'm like, do we have to turn around and go home? You know, at this point, it's like 7 p.m., 7:30 p.m. And I finally get her on the phone. And she said, oh, I just decided to go home and take a nap before I went over there. And if it had been a child, as opposed to a childlike adult,
yeah.
I mean, he wasn't capable of, you know, making his own food, of like, you know, that wouldn't have happened.
That's right.
So recognize that people aren't going to want to help you in the same way they're going to want to help you if you had a bouncing baby beauty, you know. The level of care might be similar, but the way that people want to get involved is opposite. People are repelled.
Yeah. And so lower expectations.
Yeah. Or, you know, sit down with people in your life and really say, like, this is going to be harder than I think. And I know that in ways that I haven't imagined yet. Everything I can imagine is all I can imagine. There are a billion things out there that are outside of the realm of what I can imagine.
Yeah.
So just talk to the people in your life, I would say. You know, my parents were divorced. And so, you know, my mother was just like, put him in a home. And now, of course, she's like, well, I'm going to have to come and live with you. I'm like, I see. What's good for the goose is not good for the gander, you know?
I think that when we're talking about sort of your experience with dementia, your experience with this cancer diagnosis and this journey that you're on, sort of coming to not quite the end, but you know, there's some stuff, some pretty important things that are behind you. And this question of support and people showing up, how did you find the support? Was it more than you expected? Or did you have any expectations of support?
I'm going to give you a second to think while I say that the overlap there is that people are uncomfortable.
Exactly. That's why I'm asking. Yeah.
Yeah. People are uncomfortable. Absolutely. You know, like Risa, you might feel like people want you to wear a wig because your bald head made them confront their own mortality. And same thing, like looking at a demented old man trying to have a conversation with you makes people confront their own fears and their own mortality. So there is a big overlap there.
Yes.
Risa, I'm going to let you finish.
No, it's true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
There was definitely moments where people would be like, how are you doing? You must be done chemo by now or whatever. I'd be like, I'm doing 6 months of chemo. Like I'm not done chemo. Like I go every week and get poison in my veins and like all of my hair. Like, no, I'm not done chemo, just because for you, the time of attention to my story has like kind of been eclipsed by your own life and your own urgencies.
Yes.
We're still really in it.
Yeah.
Which is so fair. Like I've been there too, where I've been like, oh my God, I completely forgot that this person is going through this. Let me check back in. And they're like right in the underworld of it.
Yeah.
So that was definitely a piece. I mean, I'm somebody who was very like, I got diagnosed. I went to a party like 3 days later, and just everyone I ended up next to, I was like, so I have cancer. So this is happening. Like friend's boyfriend or whatever was like, I have to have my breasts removed. I have to decide if I'm going to do one or two. Like I don't have a filter anymore. If I ever did. And I really was just like, I left that party. There was like a group of like six people around me and they were like, what can we do? Like, what can we do? I was like, you should start a group chat and send me gossip and like funny things, and you should check in on me. Okay, bye. Like, I'm very like, please be here for me, you know?
Yeah.
And I lost some of that ability through the chemo time and the surgery time. I lost some of that ability. And I mean, chemo makes you chemically depressed.
Yeah.
But at least I knew that's what was happening. Like, I could see my brain saying horrible things to myself about the people I loved and about myself. And that was when I really did feel sort of abandoned. It kind of coincided with people, it having just been a really long time. But I do think the one thing that I keep coming back to that I think helps me the most these days, and I think could help somebody going into a long-term care relationship with an elder, and I think can help in our sense of powerlessness and our political movements too, is recurring hangs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Like, book a recurring hang.
Yes.
Say every Monday, come over for soup club. Or
yes.
We do Stitch and Bitch, or we do whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, I used to go to Amy's. We would play music. We would yell, scream. It would make her dad a bit nuts. He would walk around sort of on his loops, on his patterns. I watched Amy go through like the mental hell of some of it, but I also like got to experience the huge emotional relief of just watching Amy sing whatever it was, Tea for the Tiller Man or something, over and over and over again, louder and louder and louder, and the big shaky off relief. Or just getting together to watch Drag Race or whatever it was. Like,
yeah,
I recommend recurring hangs.
Yes.
Call it a coven or call it a drag watch party or whatever it is. But have something that you don't have to schedule every week.
Yeah.
That you can continue to invite people to as you meet kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And where people come to you and you slowly, over repeated exposure, lower your masks with each other, lower your performative things, and share what you are afraid of, what you're experiencing, what is fucked about the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Recurring hangs.
I love recurring hangs. Amy's nodding. Anything else on top of recurring hangs for you?
I think, again, like the kind of radical honesty that Risa was talking about. Mm-hmm. It kind of goes back to that, like, the likability thing that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You know, to have the courage to say, this is what I need from you.
Yeah.
And not to, like, suffer in silence.
Mm-hmm.
It is very tempting, and, you know, I've written about this many times, because it's more devastating to ask for help and not get it than it is to keep your mouth shut and do it by yourself. It's much easier to just.
True.
Yeah, right? And so to like, to have the strength of vulnerability, to ask people to be gentle with you, to ask for help. I think you said right off the jump, Zoe, like, you know, asking for help is difficult. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it just feels like more shit you gotta do. Like, I already have this overwhelm, and now I have to add this other overwhelming thing of asking for help. Mm-hmm. But it really, I think you will often be surprised at the things that come out when you ask for them. And again, whether we're talking about just like our human relationships, or whether we're talking about magic, whether we're taking that vulnerability to our altar or to our friend group, I think is kind of the same thing. But if you have that, like, well, no one's going to help me, I can't ask for help, then you can take that to your altar, take it to the moon, take it to the dirt, yes, and just like actually say out loud, like, I need help.
Yes.
I think that's where a lot of religion comes from. I need a non-human to ask for help because I don't know where to turn.
Yeah.
And so for witches, that becomes easy because we can take a blade of grass and ask it to help us. We can, you know, mm-hmm, take a clump of dirt in our hands and smell it and, mm-hmm, and feel that like relief going through our systems. But again, vulnerability, ask for help, altar, moon, friend group, family, have the strength of vulnerability to ask for help.
Yeah, I love that. So true. And don't be afraid of the answers that we get.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big thing, right? When you are, I found that too, where I had to be like, it's okay if no one shows.
Yeah.
But I have to ask anyway. Like with the recurring hang, the first time I invited people here for my recurring Tuesday salon in Montreal during radiation, nobody could come.
Mm-hmm.
And, or like, you know, as an event organizer, you have to deal with that all the time, mm-hmm, where you're like, I got 6 people instead of 100 or whatever it is. And I just having to be really consciously at peace with, like, I'm supposed to be with who shows up is something I tell myself a lot. Like, the people who are here, even if it's one person, is like all of the richness and brilliance of life just walked in the door with that one person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, mm-hmm, all of divinity, whatever it is, just walked in the door with that one person.
Yeah. Like,
what a gift to get to be together, you know?
I have to add that there was like this witch event in Montreal. And like, I don't know, Facebook, whatever, 25 people said they were coming. And when I showed up, there were 3 of us, 3 people who showed up. And now maybe we're supposed to be disappointed. There were supposed to be 25 people here who said they were going to come. But I got very close to those 2 people who also showed up. And it became this, like, these were the people that I was meant to be with in that moment. So I could be disappointed. It wasn't even my event, you know, but I could be disappointed. Oh, not enough people came. But when it's the right people showing up, and you know, because the people who show up are the right people to show up.
Yeah.
So again, it's exactly what Risa was saying. Like, you invite the world and maybe only 2 people show up, but then maybe you can really build something super foundational with those 2 people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or you get nobody and you're like, oh fuck, I was exhausted.
Listen,
I need it.
Thank God nobody is coming.
I love it when people cancel.
Oh my God. And I'm not encouraging my students to cancel on me, but it seems like almost every time I'm supposed to like meet with like a student, they'll be like, oh my God, I'm traveling this weekend. Or, oh my God, I'm not feeling so well. And the minute I get that, I'm like, oh my God, thank goodness. Because I really just want to be on the couch watching TV right now. Like, I really just want to be like eating tacos or having wine or... And yes, we can reschedule.
Yes, we can reschedule.
Everything is fine.
Everything is fine. And then like the next Tuesday, everybody came. And suddenly I was like a fucking party and I was introducing people who were meant to meet each other, you know? And so I think that goes back to the look for the medicine that's showing up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, what is here? We could spend our whole lives feeling like regretful or putting ourselves down for every happening.
But yeah.
I'm a classic Pollyanna. Like, I read those novels when mm-hmm. I was little, and it was like seeing myself. Like, I was like, yep, I get it, lady. Like, exactly. Me too. Sam. Everything is good. Like, everything that happens, she's like, but, you know, we could think about it in yeah. the sense that.
Yeah.
Because I had so many people in my life who were so full of regret.
Yeah.
And I felt the weight of that.
Yes.
And it's irritating as hell also just yeah. to be around people who are like, oh, I really wish I could have. I just feel so bad that, oh, and you just feel that, oh, that's. Do you, I mean, you may not believe in like vibes or energy, but trust me, other people can feel that. Like,
that's right.
And so I don't know. I just wanted to always be like, there's something. I'm a relentless optimist, you yeah. know. Like, I just believe, like, it's called cognitive ease. Apparently, I interviewed a neuroscientist lately,
okay.
and he said, like, cognitive ease is a related concept where. If we use divination, for example, to make a choice,
mm-hmm.
We don't know that that choice was better than another choice, and mm-hmm. we'll never know because that's life. It's probabilities. We just make a gamble and we go.
Yeah.
But having something tell us to do it and then either choosing that or noticing inside us is like, oh, that's not right, and choosing something else, it gives us cognitive ease.
Mm.
And that in and of itself is a great mental gift, right? And I think for me, that's what being a Pollyanna is too. It's a real part of my magical practice,
mm-hmm.
is it's I choose the path that gives me more ease.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than seeing myself as surrounded by demons on a path of constant torment, mm-hmm. or I want to choose to see that that there's always medicine, that there's always like a good idea somewhere that just stepped into the room if I'm like attentive, mm-hmm. attuned. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My spouse. Sorry, but my spouse calls it my superpower, like my ability to have a good time in any situation, in any environment.
It is a superpower.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just like, yeah, I'm relentlessly, because again, like, you know, you're growing up, you're in an environment that you can't control. How can I make this okay for me?
Yes.
How can I make this okay for me? And so that just like transformed into this superpower where I don't know about everybody else, but I can have fun in any situation. I can't necessarily make it fun for you, but I'm having a great time.
Yeah,
you know, it's raining. Let's dance in the rain.
You know,
let's jump in the puddles.
Yeah.
Like, and so for me, like that is a superpower that is been so beneficial in my life-saving superpower.
Yeah, I adore this conversation. I adore this cognitive ease.
Mm.
Did I tell you about my fear walking across your lake?
A little bit, but tell the listeners.
Oh my goodness, listeners. So we had a magical weekend at Reese's house in February, so 2 months ago, which is wild. And so Risa says, do you want to go snowshoeing? I've never been snowshoeing. Said, sure. Snowshoeing, absolutely.
Yeah, the other witches we're with are like hard pass.
Right. And I had said I wasn't going to go out in the snow and play on the way there. Yeah. And then I got there and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go. Snow up to my knees. Fine. I don't have snowshoes. I just got here. I don't have the appropriate clothes for anything. And so
Zoe was like, yes, please. And then afterwards she was like, never snowshoed in my life.
So put the snowshoes on and we go out onto the lake. Just behind her house, and we take like three steps, and Risa says, the water's above your head now. Thanks. Okay. So what that means, if the water was not frozen, it would be above my head. We took like 3 feet. Then we get out to the middle, and she says, it's 150 feet deep now. I'm like, oh my God, like I am out here. It is snowing. Like, oh my God. So then she says, let's go to the little hidey hole, magical tree that's fallen, that's created like this little beautiful thing that we could actually get into. So she's walking ahead of me. I'm walking behind her. I'm like, oh my God, what if this ice cracks? What if I fall through the ice? What if Risa falls through the ice? If I fall through the ice, Risa can't pull me out of the ice. What's going to happen? right? But I keep going. And then I'm like, you know what? Risa said people race around the ice. She said people can drive on the ice. I trust Risa. I'm fine. Cognitive ease. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to enjoy and like crawl into the broken tree.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh God, what if the tree breaks? What is that? No, this tree has been here for I don't know how long. Risa's children, or her husband and her child, they be in the tree. I'm fine in the tree. So here I am crawling into the tree. We're eating apples.
Yeah.
And it was a good time.
And then Zoe said to me, I want to remember your exact phrasing because it was so beautiful. You said, what a beautiful childhood they're having, you and I.
Yeah. Because we had said that earlier. Mm. And I felt like that. I felt like we were little girls, like in this little hidey hole. But I had to have that ease.
Yes.
And that trust.
That moment of choosing the beauty of it.
And it was so beautiful.
So, and the winds whipping in our faces. And I didn't want to scare you, but I did feel like it's sort of important to know the true heft of what you're doing.
Right.
Like to really feel we're not on a path.
No.
Like we're in a deep relationship with water right now.
Yes.
Like walking on water.
Yes.
And it's like scary, but if you're gonna get the hit of fear and strength and power out of it, you have to know the real thing.
Yes, right? And it was real. But it was good. And walking back, it was like, and you had said it's going to be harder to come back than go, but it wasn't.
No, the wind shifted.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was nice.
And then we tobogganed and jumped off of the snow into a snow mound.
Yeah. We jumped off like a 12-foot cliff into a pile of snow. And Amy was like, I've seen snow. I'm going to stay inside by myself. It's going to be real nice. I'm going to stir this pot and ferment with my sweet self.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add a converse reality, which was Amy Miranda. I'm sure she would be fine with me saying this, but
okay.
Amy Miranda's reaction, I said, you can walk right out to the middle of the lake. And she looked at me and she said, nice try. Like I was trying to trick her into like dying. And you know, it's hard to trust people sometimes. It's hard to like not be scared. And I get that too. You know,
yeah.
I will say I've seen snow recently, you know this, but that became kind of like a meme in my family because when my spouse and I were getting close to our wedding and somebody asked my father, are you excited about Amy's wedding? You know, his daughter is getting married. And he said, oh, I've been to lots of weddings. And it was like hilarious and heartbreaking at the same time, you know, but that's just like something that we say like, oh, you want to go to the concert? And then we'll be like, oh, I've been to lots of concerts. Do you want to go out in the snow? I've seen snow.
Oh my gosh. Okay. This was so good. This was so good. I love talking with you too.
Same.
Of course.
Love hanging out with you. Thank you so much for letting us be a part of this space.
Oh my
goodness. Your listeners.
This is so great. So I always like to ask, as we come to a close of this part of the conversation, what are you grieving and what are you grateful for? And either one of you can go first.
I am grieving naivete. I am grieving a time where I felt like people were good, if that makes sense. I am grieving, being able to listen to my Buffy St. Marie records and my Kanye West records without a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. I'm grieving naivete. I feel like I know too much. And I miss being able to go into the world with like a blissful ignorance. Yeah. And I'm grateful for everything else. I'm grateful for perennials. I'm grateful for plants that come back every year, like beacons of hope after winter, and being able to see myself in those little tiny green shoots that eventually will be daylilies, and they'll be strong and orange and tall. Yeah, I'm grieving naivete, and I'm grateful for pretty much everything else.
I love it. Thank you.
That's so well said. I feel like I'm going to say something quite similar in different words, because that sums up so much, right? But I'll tell you this. My daughter was here. I'm staying apart from them for the days of the week. I'm doing radiation, and then we're together on the weekends. She's six, and the cancer journey is really hard for kids, but she's doing great. I was telling her I kind of really like my short hair. It's growing back a little bit. It's kind of very Sinead right now. It's kind of giving. And I was like, I might keep it. It's kind of cute. And she started to heartbreak, sob. And we realized after a little bit of talking, I was like, oh, do you want everything to go back to the way it was? And she said, yeah. And I think that's part of what we're grieving, you know, that we never do go back to the way things were. And so, yeah, there's like, I'm not even sure I ever was that woman, but there was a woman that I imagined sometimes, and I can't go back to her.
Yeah.
The way that I thought of myself in a way is not something, even, you know, if I do grow my hair back and my new fake boobs are adorable, and, you know, even if I put on that performance again perfectly with the same clothes, you never really can lose the awareness that that is something you can put on and take off. That's and that right. It will eventually be shed, you know. Once you know that, you never unknow it. And I'm also really grateful for that knowledge.
Yeah.
That's a heartbreak.
Yeah.
You know, it's like youth and health and like this sort of spinning beauty of something femme or whatever that was never totally me, but I know I won't have it again, even the delusion of it, even the glamour of it. And I'm really, really thankful for this body. Like, I'm really thankful to be alive even in this, like, fucked up moment, you know? Fascism and climate crisis and all of it, like, fucking all of it. I'm fucking alive.
That's right.
So.
That's right.
Yay.
I know. Last week I was having, like, just, like, a low moment. Yeah. And I literally just grabbed my journal and I wrote down, you're alive at the most important time in history. Like, I just have to, like, fucking just be like, girl, it's okay.
It's okay.
Like, you chose to be here this time. So fucking try to enjoy what you can.
Right. Like, I mean, we still can feel music move through us. We still can feel the wind, you know. I am moved by the kindness and generosity of humans every day. They aren't all fucked, you know. Being in the healthcare system will remind you of that, because there are so many angels there.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, y'all. Thank you. How can people get a hold of you? How can they connect with you? How can they support the work?
I think I've done a pretty good job of centralizing everything at missingwitches.com. You can find our coven, information about our coven there. Check it out. See if it feels like a nice home for you. If you're looking for trans-inclusive, pro-science, awe-loving coven that welcomes men and women and queer people, and where people teach each other and learn together, maybe that's like a space for you. We have two books.
And a deck.
And a deck. We're really proud of our books. Missing Witches, Recovering True Histories of Feminist Magic and New Moon Magic, 13 Anti-Capitalist Tools for Reenchanting the World.
Resistance and Reenchantment.
Resistance and Reenchantment. They're really long texts, but they're great books, I swear.
Uh-huh. And your Oracle deck, which is it just Missing Witches Oracle deck?
The Missing Witches deck of Oracles, yeah. But I do want to shout out that the month of May is reparations month for us. So we pay forward our earnings for the month of May to the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. And for the past few years, we've been gathering prizes and encouraging our listeners to find a local Indigenous support org. So that runs all through the month of May. And if your listeners are interested in that, please come back to missingwitches.com on May 1st. Thousands of dollars worth of prizes are available for donors. And if you want the tea on that, it'll be up on missingwitches.com on May 1st.
I'll just add, the prizes are very deliciously witchy. Like, if you want like a reading or like a one-on-one art ritual practice with a professional artist and witch that would normally cost hundreds of dollars and aren't offered to the public, those are the kinds of things that are on offer. And so every donation of $10 to your local Native or Indigenous support org, or you can just support the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, every $10 gets you an entry into the draw.
Okay. All right. Thank you both. Again, this has just been so good. And yeah, I feel full. I'm excited. So that's it, folks.
I will see you all very soon. I'm Zoe Flowers. Thank you. Bye.
We love you, Zoe Flowers.
I love you.
I love Zoe Flowers.